Welcome to Humanize from Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism, where human rights meet human responsibilities. We speak with writers, thinkers, and newsmakers on the controversial issues of human life and human thriving that impact our daily lives. We are exceptional as creatures in the cosmos, as equal members of the human family, and as ethical beings. Humanize explores some of the fundamental questions. How do we thrive? How do we live well and care for what we've inherited? How do we act responsibly with one another and in the wider world? And how do we conserve the good things of this life for the future? We matter. Our actions matter. Let's get into it. I'm Wesley J. Smith, and this is Humanize. For those who may not remember, Terri Schiavo was a profoundly cognitively disabled woman who became the subject of a legal and cultural battle that made international headlines. The case became a bitter and protracted conflict between Michael Schiavo, Terri's estranged husband who wanted to pull her feeding tube, and the Schindler family that fought to save their child and sister's life. In the end, the courts granted Schiavo permission to do as he wanted. It took 2 weeks for Terri to die. This year marks the 20th anniversary of her death, and it seems a good time to take stock of the meaning and legacy of her case. My guest is Terri's brother, Bobby Schindler. He is president of the Terri Schiavo Life and Hope Network that advocates for the medically vulnerable. The Life and Hope Network has been instrumental in providing resources and support to over 4,000 patients and families at the risk of euthanasia, assisted suicide, and denial of care situations from physicians, hospitals, insurance companies, and others. Schindler is also a Paige Comstock Cunningham Senior Fellow at Americans United for Life and an associate scholar at the Charlotte Lozier Institute. Bobby is a regular contributor to Life News. His writings have also appeared in the Wall Street Journal, Chicago Tribune, Time, National Review, Human Life Review, Town Hall, The Federalist, The Daily Caller, The Washington Times, and others. Bobby and his family authored the book, A Life That Matters, The Legacy of Terri Schiavo. Bobby has spoken in more than 46 states and in over a dozen countries. He has testified before state legislatures in Texas, Florida, Louisiana, California, Kentucky, and Ohio, and has addressed members of parliament in Australia and Canada concerning the protection of the medically vulnerable. Bobby holds an MS in bioethics and a certificate in healthcare ethics from the National Catholic Bioethics Center, as well as degrees from LaSalle University and Florida State University. This is his second appearance on this podcast. He is also my friend. Bobby, welcome back to Humanize.
Thanks, Wesley. Always a pleasure. Good talking to you.
How old was Terri when she suffered her brain injury that led to her having serious cognitive difficulties?
26.
And we still don't know what happened, correct?
Still don't know. I don't think we ever will.
And when she collapsed and went to the hospital, what was her diagnosis or prognosis?
Well, initially, they were uncertain. I mean, they didn't paint a very good prognosis for my family. But she did. I mean, she did need all types of support to sustain her life, but in a relatively short period of time, perhaps a couple weeks, maybe a month, the only thing left sustaining her was food and hydration. She still had, through a feeding tube, she still had difficulty swallowing because of her brain injury, but it was just a feeding tube that was sustaining her, and that was all she needed up until it was removed in 2005.
So I want this to be really clear, because a lot of times the media talks about her as being on life support and this kind of thing. She was not on a ventilator. She was not receiving kidney dialysis. She was able to do all of breathe on her own, process waste on her own, and so forth. But she just needed sustenance like we all do. And because you don't want aspiration, you didn't want her to, because of swallowing issues, she used a feeding tube, which is a very common medical procedure, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And this is throughout this entire saga that we'll discuss.
That's correct, yes. And if you like, I can... I mean, Terry did receive aggressive therapy and rehabilitation within a couple of years of her collapse, and she was making progress, and so much so it was noted in her medical files that she was starting to form words. So there was some optimism initially with Terry's recovery. But unfortunately, as we know, that was all stopped.
And who Michael Shiva was her husband. Tell me a little bit about him. At first, after her injury, you all had a good relationship, your family and him, correct?
That's right. Initially, Michael was appointed for a court. He was appointed by the court to be her guardian. Unbeknownst to our family, by the way, there was a hearing. He was appointed the guardian. And initially he was working with my parents. Now, I will mention, and I think we didn't know at the time, but simultaneously, within a short period of time after Terry's collapse, Michael did start investigating a medical malpractice lawsuit against Terry's treating physician and gynecologist, blaming them for her accident. So he was seeking a significant amount of money, and this, as I said, he started investigating this possibility shortly thereafter Terry's collapse, and I only say that because perhaps that was what was motivating Michael to provide her the care he was providing, because as we saw after the medical malpractice lawsuit, everything changed.
Well, let's not get ahead of ourselves. So yeah. For a while, Michael and your family were working together, providing Terry with aggressive therapy.
Yeah, I was just making the point. I think there are alternative motives for that relationship to be as congenial. As much as it could be, I guess.
So the lawsuit was filed, and your father was aware of it, and sure. And your family.
They were supportive of it. Yes.
Yeah, and he actually lived with your folks for a while, didn't he?
We brought Terry home. They brought Terry home for a short period of time, and were caring for her at home. Yes, with my parents.
And then the malpractice case settled for I forgot how much money, about $1 million.
A little more, about 1.5. Michael was seeking $20 million for Terry's lifelong care, but the jury awarded I think it was around $1.5 million, and Michael actually walked away, lost a consortium. I believe it was $650,000.
And then he was named the guardian of the money that she had, which was supposed to care for her.
Well, it was put in a medical trust fund, so the bank had... I guess the bank had control, but Michael was the only person who could decide where the money was going to be used, with the bank's consent, of course.
And just for the audience, I was deeply immersed in writing about this case all along. So I'm pretty familiar with these facts, and my recollection is that everything was fine until the money was in the bank, and then there was a change of attitude, at least from your perspective, with regard to Michael's approach toward Terry. Explain that.
Almost immediately, Wesley, that is correct. So Terry collapses in 1990, my parents and Michael working together, providing Terry the best care, rehabilitation, she's improving. From roughly 1990 up until mid-1991, the medical malpractice lawsuit, it was in 1992, and in January of 1993, shortly after the conclusion of the medical malpractice lawsuit, was when the medical trust was established. So it was in February, just a month later, when everything changed, when my dad approached Michael, asking him when he was going to use the money from the malpractice trial and start applying it to Terry's rehabilitation and therapy, like Michael promised. And a fight erupted between my father and Michael, and it was at that time Michael said he will be making the decisions from this point forward, and he essentially severed his relationship with my parents, and from that point on, they no longer had any input, or really had any knowledge of Terry's care or treatment, because Michael had instructed all her caregivers to not lend any information or provide any information to my parents. And this started in February of 1993.
At some point, he decided that he was going to withhold antibiotics from her, obviously towards the end that she would die a natural death. How did you all find out about that, and what was the result of your discovery?
So as I just mentioned, February is when my parents had the falling out, and we don't know the exact time frame, but it was shortly thereafter. We believe in May, so just a couple few months after February, Michael instructed the nursing home to, as you said, Terry had a UT infection, and not to treat it with simple antibiotics. And the nursing home intervened and said they can't do that. They have to treat. We only found out because Michael had instructed Terry, as I said, not to give any information to my parents. Well, a nurse called my parents inside when they were visiting Terry one day and violated, I guess, Michael's instructions and said, you better watch what's going on with your daughter, because Michael just tried to end her life by refusing to treat a UT infection. When my parents learned and found that out, they immediately sought an attorney to file an injunction or whatever you would call it, Wesley, you would know better than me, to remove Michael's guardian once they learned that he tried to do this.
And that case eventually settled, correct?
My parents lost that case for guardianship. Michael retained guardian. And that was just a few months after that first incident to stop the UT infection.
But he was required to inform your parents of medical decisions.
I think that's correct. From that point on, he was not allowed to withhold information about Terry's care. Correct.
Obviously, the best way to know what was happening back then would be with the guardianship files. It's my understanding that you have recently attempted to gain access to those files to see what the truth is and were denied by a court. Is that right?
Right. There's an enormous amount of files. And when Terry died, Michael had a certain portion of them sealed immediately. And we're trying to access them to see exactly why he was so quick to seal them.
So you don't know what's in them, but you'd sure like to.
We don't know what's in them. Michael is fighting he's aggressively fighting from this happening. He does not, I guess he does not want these files to be reopened. We're very curious to understand and know why Michael's fighting so hard. It's been 20 years, but nonetheless, he is trying to stop these files from being unsealed.
I called Michael the estranged husband in the introduction, and I did that. Not because there had been a formal divorce filed, but because he, during the time of these events, he was living with another woman and, in fact, had two children with her. The courts didn't seem to care about that, did they?
No. No, they did not, actually, unfortunately.
And it seems to me that, you know, that's a bigger conflict of interest potentially than the money. Because if you're living with a woman, she's having your children, it's going to make for interesting pillow talk while you're not married.
Yeah, it seems to me that his loyalties, and I think even by his behavior and his actions, his loyalties shifted from, you know, to work in Terry's best interest. Now he was more concerned about his fiancée, his future wife, and as you mentioned, the kids that he had with this woman while he was trying to end Terry's life.
And after she died, he did marry her, correct?
I think about a year, maybe not even a year, but yes, shortly thereafter Terry's death. And he made that clear, Wesley, once Michael filed the petition to remove Terry's feeding tube, he did not hide the fact that he was going to marry this woman once Terry, if he was successful in ending Terry's life.
And I remember at the time being kind of astonished. Not only did the judge not care about this clear personal conflict of interest, but the media didn't care. They rarely reported it. They just referred to him as a loving husband.
Right. And when my parents found out way back in the early 90s that Michael was with another woman, my dad, and I think this is of the record, so to speak, my dad wrote a letter to Michael saying, look, we understand you're with another woman. That's fine. You're moving on with your life. Give Terry back to us. Let us care for her from this point on. And this was before he made a formal petition to remove her feeding tube. This was after we had known that he was trying to end her life with the UT, withholding antibiotics. And that was what kind of triggered my dad to write him a letter asking him, look, you're obviously moving on with your life. Let us take care of Terry and you can do that. And of course, Michael ignored this letter from my father and I think it was, you know, obvious if he did, he would lose access to the medical trust fund if Terry would ever die.
How did the case burst into such prominent public awareness for younger listeners or people who might not recall? I mean, this case was national headlines, front page news, television news stories, interview after interview after interview for about 3 years, all around the world. How did it come to the place where it received such prominence?
Yeah, that's I get that question asked quite frequently, and it's a tough one to answer. It started out locally in St. Petersburg, Tampa, and it was getting extensive coverage in that area. It was controversial, husband fighting the parents, but it stayed local, and it wasn't really until I think two things triggered it. One is Glenn Beck got involved, who was a local conservative talk show host in the Tampa Bay area. He got involved, and he was actually on the other side. He was supporting Michael's efforts at one point and had an epiphany and came out after a weekend thinking about what was happening and came out to support my family. But almost around the same time, Jeb Bush got involved. And so when Jeb Bush got involved, I think it started to really start snowballing, because you had a governor of Florida now getting involved, advocating, trying to stop this from happening. And the Florida legislature was also getting involved. And at the same time, Glenn Beck went from a local conservative talk show host, and he got promoted, so to speak, and was now a national talk show host. He moved from Tampa to Philadelphia, and he had hundreds of stations all over the country. And he took Terry's case with him. He saw the injustice, what was going on, and he was doing everything he could to put pressure on officials, Jeb Bush and others, to get involved to stop this from happening. And so I think the dynamics of those two things, you had a governor of Florida getting involved, who was also the brother of the president at the time, and then you had Glenn Beck almost daily just pounding away about this case to his listeners, which was a national audience now, and I think that was really kind of raising the awareness or the publicity of Terry's case.
As I recall, Rush Limbaugh also talked about it.
Well, it was, I got to tell you, I mean, as you mentioned, I mean, somewhere around 2003, I guess, 2004, I mean, this case was getting talked about by almost every major conservative outlet in the country. Yeah, Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, O'Reilly, all of them. It was on their radar, and they started to talk about it.
I think also one of the things that really moved it to prominence was something I think your family pioneered. This is in the early days of the internet, and you took videos of Terry, for example, your mother coming in and saying, "Hi, sweetie," and Terry smiling broadly towards your mother. And you uploaded that onto the internet so that people could actually see her, and that humanized Terry in a way that an abstract discussion that she's unconscious or whatever would never have done. So I think that was also part of it. And I think you guys, you and your parents and your sister, you pioneered that approach to public advocacy.
Right, you're right. I mean, we created a website. I had a friend who was a website designer. And this was kind of in the beginning of when websites were coming on. They're becoming popular. So we created a website, and we released the videos. My dad saw what was going on, how the media was reporting this, the secular media or the mainstream media, and how they were already at that time, Wesley, they were really reporting a lot of misinformation and inaccuracies. And my dad said he's going to do everything in his power to expose this injustice. So my dad, we were reaching out to anybody we could that we felt could help within the parameters of the law, obviously. I mean, but there wasn't anybody my dad wasn't going to try and contact to seek help to expose this injustice. And yeah, I would give a lot of credit to my father and what he did to expose what Michael was trying to do and the courts were trying to do.
Your father ended up, shortly after Terry died, having a terrible blood pressure issue that took his life, didn't he?
He had a stroke not long after Terry's death, and he had a very difficult time, as I guess any father can imagine. And he told me, I'll never forget, I don't know if jumping ahead here, but he told me privately, very quietly, that he would not be able to forgive himself, was not be able to forgive himself for not being able to protect his daughter from allowing this to happen.
Yeah, and even though he spent all his money, he worked tirelessly, so did all of you, your sister, you, your mother, he felt guilty that he didn't protect his girl.
Yes. And you would never know that with my dad, because in public, he would always hide that, I guess. But my dad was deeply depressed and suffering terribly from.
Do you think that the case helped lead to his death?
Oh, no doubt. He couldn't. He had a difficult time handling her. I mean, as anybody can ever imagine, he was heartbroken over what happened, and it was just a horrible, terrible injustice. And her death, how they killed Terry, was to this day it's hard to believe that we would do that to a human being.
I'm going to get to that in just a second. I'm very interested, and I think the audience might be, in the personal side of these kinds of things. You were a very, not private people, but you were not celebrities when this began. As I recall, you were teaching English in high school, correct?
I was science and math, but yes, I was a high school teacher.
Science and math, and your dad had been a businessman and was retired?
Semi-retired. He actually had to find a job because of the expense, the pressures of the money from this case. But yeah, he was essentially retired.
So essentially, you were private people. You were, you know, you were not celebrities. You were not in the public eye. Nor was Michael. Michael had become a nurse after Terry's injury. And so you were all private people in the sense that you were not public figures. And then you were suddenly public figures. I mean, in the most incredibly visible way. What was that like? I don't think any of us who haven't experienced that would understand it.
Yeah, it's still kind of, you look back, Wesley, you know, we were so focused on helping and protecting and defending Terry. And a lot of the noise that was occurring around us, I mean, obviously you noticed it, but it was all for the purpose of helping my sister. And it was very stressful. It was very demanding, I guess. My parents, you know, it was very difficult. My dad, as you kind of alluded, was having terrible health issues with his blood pressure and just the stress. I mean, we were getting ruling after Judge Greer, I don't know what the percentage was, but ruled against us almost every single time. And legally, we were getting really no relief. And it was only by some wonderful attorneys that we had that it lasted as long as it did.
The state of Florida passed a law requiring the case to be reviewed, right?
Yeah, they did. I mean, I guess we had some success with the appellate court, but the lower court, Greer, gave us really no relief. And we did get some relief from the appellate court. But it was all, I mean, this was all in an effort to stop this, and I'll say it over and over, this terrible injustice that was going to be imposed on my sister. And we knew how it was going to end up. I mean, we knew it was going to be a death by starvation and dehydration. And we just, you know, my dad, as I mentioned, was going to do anything in his power that he could to stop this from happening. And with one intention, Wesley, was just to care for Terry. I mean, provide her the life-affirming care, the proper and basic care, the basic necessity we all need to live. And that was my dad's only intention. All this other stuff that was being printed about my father, the way he was attacked, the way he was, you know, their intentions were being undermined the way they were kind of portraying my parents' intentions, they were saying they were doing it for money. All this stuff that was being reported just wasn't true. And you're right, my parents were very private. And but my dad was going to do anything he could to protect his daughter and stop this from happening.
And eventually the case got to the United States Congress, and a law was passed that was signed by President George W. Bush that basically took the case and sent it to a federal court and said, do basically a trial de novo. Make sure that this case was handled correctly, because there were so many irregularities is a polite word for it. For example, she did not have she had a guardian ad litem to begin with, who was supposed to represent her interests. The guardian ad litem recommended against taking away her feeding tube. Michael's attorney was able to get the guardian ad litem kicked off the case, and then Judge Greer never appointed another guardian ad litem, even though Florida law requires a guardian ad litem. That's just one example.
Right. Incredibly, Judge Greer was acting as her default attorney, and that was one of the things I think our lawyers were trying to get overturned or whatever. We're trying to find relief because we had an attorney, our parents did, Michael had an attorney, but Terry had no one representing her. And Judge Greer was acting as her default attorney, which was completely improper. So that was one problem. There was a lot of problems. But Congress, and you could maybe elaborate or maybe speak more to this, but and the media has really did such a terrible way of reported this. They essentially took a look at Terry's case, and they compared it to a death penalty case where someone on death row is going to have a federal review to make sure that the state court acted properly before you end someone on death row's life. Well, they felt Terry, a disabled woman, should have been offered or afforded the same protections, that before you're going to end her life, she should receive a federal review. And I believe my understanding is that's what the bill Congress passed was to basically mimic or mirror the laws that are in place for those that are on death row, to give them that one last review before you end their life.
In subsequent politics, that federal law has been described as a Republican and conservative agenda. But how many Democrat senators voted against that law? Do you remember?
Zero.
Exactly, zero. Hillary Clinton. Zero. Zero. It was the most bipartisan bill in the George W. Bush presidency, except for perhaps the Iraq War. I mean, it was. There were very few visible and vocal opponents among the Democrats, and in the House, because this was all done very quickly, not every House member voted, but at least 45% of the Democratic caucus voted for what was known as Terry's bill or Terry's law. So this was viewed as a bipartisan issue because this young woman was so vulnerable and helpless, and there were so many potential irregularities in the state processes. And unfortunately, the judge, the federal judge in the case, decided not to look at the whole thing. He just basically did a cursory review and then said everything is fine.
He rubber stamped it.
Yeah, and that brings us to your sister's death. What date did that happen?
Well, her feeding tube was removed on March 18th, 2005, and then she died on March 31st, 13 days later.
13 days later. Now, they were, as I recall, there was attempts by bioethicists and others to say, oh, this will be a peaceful death, and it's very gentle and so forth. What did you witness?
Right. There was all kind of narratives that were being pushed about my sister's case, and one of them was that the way she died was peaceful and painless, and it was completely contrary to everything we saw during my sister's two-week death. It was terribly barbaric, horrifying to have to watch a human being slowly die by dehydration and starvation. And it's why we have laws where we can't do that to an animal, Wesley. It would be a crime. We would be in jail. But yet, every single day, and that's why we are still talking about Terry's case today, because every single day, what happened to Terry 20 years ago continues to happen and countless healthcare facilities, not in our country, but globally as well. But it was a terrible process.
So your sister went through a grueling death. Would that be an accurate statement?
Right. I don't know how graphic you want me to get, but I can give you some description of what was happening, if you like, walking into that room just days. In fact, Wesley, I forget, it may have been 3-4 days, 5 days before Terry died, but we went out, and I remember Suzanne and I went in there came out and said, "Mom, I don't think you should go in anymore. It's really starting. She's really starting to deteriorate." And it wasn't something we wanted my mom to see her daughter being killed this way.
I remember you came out once, and a representative for Michael said that Mrs. Shivo is having a peaceful time, and you cried out, "She's bleeding from her eyes."
Yes, she was. That was George Filos, Michael's attorney. And it was so upsetting to hear him say that when I knew what was happening. And there was blood. It was from the dehydration, Wesley. And,
right, the cracking of the membranes, right?
Yeah, it's not uncommon. If you read what happens when someone is dehydrated to death, the things that they describe were happening to my sister, Terry. And she was starting to bleed. I'll never forget, I saw the blood starting to form in her eyes, and it was just terrible.
At this point, I think it's important to differentiate something here. When somebody is dying actively, they will often stop eating and drinking. And that can be a very peaceful process because it's a natural process. And that's not what we're talking about here. In Terry's case, she was able to digest, assimilate food and water and so forth. So the impact of being denied sustenance would be the same with her as it would be with any of us.
Yeah, Terry was physically healthy right before her feeding tube was removed. In fact, her autopsy validated the fact that she had a strong heart and her organs were in very good shape.
The autopsy also said that her brain had shrunk to half its size and that her condition was consistent with a persistent vegetative state. I don't like that term because no human being's a vegetable, but it's what we're stuck with, and a minimally conscious state. Now, you have convinced me, based on things you said happened in the bedroom and in her room and also the videos I saw, that she was at least minimally conscious. But I think that autopsy really tipped public opinion. What do you think?
The autopsy was terrible. The media, the way they misportrayed or spun, so to speak, Terry's autopsy. First of all, do you remember Dr. William Cheshire?
Yes, I do. Yes.
He evaluated Terry. And it's a 6 or 7 affidavit that he submitted to the court. It's a remarkable affidavit, testimony, examination from Dr. Cheshire. And he believes... He strongly believed that Terry was in a minimally conscious state, but
and
nevertheless,
it shouldn't matter because she's a human being,
right? First of all, Wesley, this whole notion that Terry's brain was half the weight of a normal brain, well, they failed to remind people or refused or failed. Our brains are 75% or 80% water weight, so. They didn't mention the, and I spoke to a doctor about this, I think it was a neurologist, and they said that Terry's brain should have been, it should have shrunk because of the lack of water. She didn't go with water for 2 weeks. So her brain should have...
Be expected to shrink, yeah.
Expected to shrink. And right. They would also compare Terry's brain to you saw this quite a bit, to Karen Ann Quinlan, who was in a similar condition to my sister, and that was a high-profile case. And what they were saying was Terry's brain was half the size of Karen Ann Quinlan, and they had the same type of brain, were in the same condition. Well, what they didn't mention was, again, Karen Ann Quinlan died a natural death. Her feeding tube wasn't removed. So she did not suffer the consequences of being without water for 2 weeks. So it's apples to oranges when you're comparing their brains. And the last thing I will comment on, it's impossible to come to any type of conclusion or determination that Terry was in a PVS from examining someone who had passed away.
The autopsy says that.
Right, but the media, if you read through the media reports, and 20 years ago, I'd have to go back, but I don't remember the media including that. They would leave that out. That you can't examine someone who has passed away and determine whether they're in a PVS or not. They must be alive.
And they acted as if the family said, "Well, she's going to recover and be able to go out and tap dance on Broadway."
Right.
And you never said that.
Never said that. They also said Terry was blind. And that could have very well been, she could have been blind at the time of death, again, because of the impact of her going without food and hydration. But there's no way to determine, and she wasn't, because we have video of her seeing with her eyes. So, but there's no way to determine it. They would kind of paint the broad brush that Terry was blind. Well, at the time of her death, she was blind because of the autopsy. It was just, but you're right. The autopsy had a tremendous impact on public opinion and changed a lot of people's minds. And I think a lot of politicians that were supporting my sister in their efforts to help her, backpedaled after the autopsy was released, and the media did such a terrible job reporting on the findings of the autopsy.
And it's important.
Real quick. There was a he wasn't a neurologist, but he was a neuro something, and he wrote up a report, and he even said in his report. And I forgot the exact wording, I'm paraphrasing, but he said, we cannot rule out the fact that Terry might have been in a minimally conscious state because you cannot determine the condition, whether someone's in a PVS or a minimally conscious state, they have to be alive.
Right. In fact, the autopsy said that.
Right. The autopsy said that. Yes.
Yeah. The autopsy said it was consistent. Her condition was consistent with either of those conditions. That's a diagnosis made during life. I want to move on to what's happened in the 20 years since with the foundation and you. But I just want to end with this point in terms of her case. It is now portrayed as like pro-lifers and arch-conservatives versus reasonable liberals. But at the time, it was actually much more pluralistic than that. You had conservatives standing with the family and liberals like Jesse Jackson, stood with the family. Ralph Nader stood
Joe
with
Lieberman.
The family. Joe Lieberman stood
Tom
with the family.
Tom Harkin
helped push through the federal law. It was not a as we see today so often. And you also had some conservatives standing with Michael because they were saying, well, you know, we cannot have the federal government interfere with state court proceedings. So it really was more of a mixed bag. But the media, I remember the New York Times wouldn't report on the case until pro-lifer who was very famous came out and stood by your side. And then the media basically said, this is an abortion case.
Right. Well, I think it goes back to we were talking about earlier about how the Democrats didn't object to the passage of the bills because it didn't fit the narrative. And I think where I thought you were going to say, which was left out quite often, if not, it was rarely reported, was not only the fact that the Democrats have stood by our family's efforts, but there was also 40 local and national disability groups, Wesley.
That's right.
That came out more publicly supporting. They came out and said that Michael was unfit to be Terry's guardian.
You had the disability rights folk trying to protect one of their own, a disabled woman.
Right. Now go back and look at the media reports, and let me know how many times you heard it was reported that we had as many. I think there was more disability groups that were public supporting our parents' efforts than there were pro-life groups, Wesley. Yet, rarely, if ever, reported by the mainstream media because it didn't fit the narrative. They wanted to frame this as a pro-life, anti-abortion, religious conservatives type of case, and it simply wasn't true.
I think this case is important because, as you know, I've been doing sanctity of life advocacy against euthanasia and so forth. For more than 30 years. And I think Terry's case was a tipping point. Before her case, people were, you know, they'd be shocked. What do you mean you can pull a person's feeding tube? People were not aware of it. And then after 3 years of Sturm und Drang, and I think media malpractice in the kindest term way I can frame it, because I think it was also intentional in some cases, public began and now do support such actions, and the ability to protect people like Terry ended, it seems to me. It's almost impossible now to prevent somebody's feeding tube from being removed if that's what a caregiver who has surrogacy rights decides.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, even today, I mean, there's been warnings, and you've been writing about them years, the troubling trends that are occurring in healthcare that are essentially being ignored or overlooked. And I think that continues today. It's probably even worsening.
And I think it leads to the assisted suicide advocacy. And you now have bioethicists actually saying that, you know, we should teach people to voluntarily starve themselves to death, and that dementia patients should be able to sign a document that would prevent caregivers from giving them food and water when they become incapacitated. So these have now become legitimate in the public eye, respectful topics of conversation, which would never have been considered respectable before Terry's death.
Right. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think one of the maybe silver linings, so to speak, I think the COVID pandemic inadvertently exposed, I think, many of the disturbing realities of what's happening in today's healthcare. I think it exposed on a national scale how treatment decision making have shifted from patient centered to an increasingly controlled external authorities, and it kind of speaks to what you're saying.
Yeah, there's a utilitarian emphasis, and there's a technocratic approach. Let the experts decide.
Right, and we're seeing more and more of that with the work that we do and the calls that we get. Really, decision-making processes are being taken out of families' hands, and they're being put in the hands of strangers, essentially. Ethics committees, insurance companies, the administrators, they're the ones deciding now what's in the best interest of the patient. And it's really kind of alarming. I mean, we get all the hard cases, Wesley. We don't hear from families that aren't struggling or having the problem because they don't need to call us. So we do get a lot of the calls from people that are having withdrawal or denial of care situations. But I think, and I don't want to oversimplify this, but of the complexities in healthcare, but I think in today's healthcare, I mean, you get admitted to a hospital, and it could be the roll of the dice if you're going to get the care that you want or not. Depending if they share your values and they're going to treat you the way you expect the treatment that you want. And we deal with these kind of decisions, and where families are fighting these decisions all the time.
And you're talking about the Terry Schiavo Life and Hope Network, which is a nonprofit that the family formed in honor of Terry, correct?
That's right. Basically serving as patient advocates for the last 20 years.
And I said in the introduction that you've handled at least 4,000 situations where people were facing forced removal of care against their will and other lethal potential consequences, and you guys have stepped into the breach to try to help them. What are some of the services that you provide for patients and families that are going through this very difficult experience?
A bunch of different we've obtained so many resources over the years. We can help legal consultations. We can actually have families retain attorneys if it gets that far. Physicians, ethical consult, emotional. People even call us for emotional support depending on the situation. Also helping them with how they can protect themselves, try and get the treatment they want if they're ever in these types of situations. But I got to tell you, Wesley, what we've been seeing, probably more recent than when we first started, kind of the trend, is how quick decisions are being made, particularly with brain injuries, to terminate or to stop this treatment. Decisions are being made hours and days, sometimes hours, within being admitted to a hospital, that there's no meaningful hope of recovery, whatever that means, and they start pressuring families to end treatment. So we're seeing more and more of those quick decisions, and it seems to me we become the arbiter of time, helping families. We never impose on crises that families might be having. Families have to contact us. All the work we do is voluntary. We volunteer all our services, and we're not vitalists, Wesley. We assess a situation, and if the help that the family's asking poor is reasonable. We're going to do everything we can to help that family. But as I said, it just the quickness of these decisions being made, particularly with all this these studies coming out on brain study and the time the brain needs to heal, the decisions and how quick they're being made it's really very, very troubling.
In fact, there have been studies that show, and correct me if I'm wrong, you would have more knowledge of this than me, that people who have been diagnosed as unconscious, about 40% of them aren't, it turns out.
Right. They're finding more and more. Well, just because of the subjective nature of determining whether someone is having any type of awareness. I mean, that was kind of the fight. That was one of the main issues in Terry's case. But there was a in the Journal of Neurotrauma, came out last year, Wesley. It was a 7-year study and involved, I think, about 1,500 patients or close thereof who had sustained traumatic brain injuries. Now, that's a little different. Terry had an anoxic brain injury. A lot of people don't realize when you say traumatic brain injuries, that's different from an anoxic brain injury. Nevertheless,
the first one would be if somebody got hit in the head,
right, like a car accident.
And your sister had a cardiac event, and oxygen was deprived to the brain.
Right, lack of oxygen, like a stroke victim, a drowning victim, near drowning. So they did these 1,500 patients over 7 years, over close to 20 trauma centers. And it was quite extraordinary what they found, Wesley. Decisions to quickly end the lives. So the conclusion was this. Researchers found, and I'm reading from the study, who received a poor prognosis had their life-sustaining treatment withdrawn within days of experiencing their brain injury. However, the study revealed that 40% of the patients who did not have their treatment removed recovered with at least some independence. So close to 50% of the people that were given a chance at rehabilitation or some type of treatment, it did in fact recover, which is quite extraordinary. If you think about...
So what you're saying is that there's a large cadre of people with traumatic brain injury who doctors or experts say, you got to let them go because there's no chance for them in a hastened or a very quick fashion, where if that decision is not made, about half of those actually have enough recovery to become somewhat independent.
That's correct. And it speaks to what I just said with the calls that we've been receiving. When I read this report, I was like, my gosh, this validates the work we've been doing with helping families because of the quickness and
the haste
and decisions that are being made without giving these individuals a chance to see if they can respond to some type of treatment.
Yeah, I mean, I remember as I was writing about the case, at that time the standard was months and months before you could even make a diagnosis of an unconscious condition.
Right, and so in 2021, Wesley, the JAMA Neurology, and in 2022, the American Academy of Neurology essentially came out with similar findings where time is needed before any type of discussion to stop life-sustaining treatment. In fact, I believe it was the American Academy of Neurology provided better or updated guidelines for doctors to wait at least a month before any of these types of decisions are made.
And you're saying that at least in the cases that are coming to your foundation, that's not happening.
Wesley, some are hours after being admitted, remarkably. When I sit there and I hear these family, I say, well, when was your loved one admitted? Yesterday? And they've already made a decision, they're going to stop treatment? Yes, we're being pressured right now, and that's why they're calling us. And we have and that's when we reach out. So in most, if not all cases, we'll almost immediately try to find them an attorney to help them. Because once an attorney intervenes, in most cases, the hospital will start to cooperate.
Just for the listener, if anybody is interested in contacting the foundation, the link to the website will be in the program notes, so you can do that. You were involved in one other very famous case, Jahi McMath, Tell us a bit about the Jahi McMath case and how you personally became involved and the foundation became involved.
Yeah, I mean, I think it speaks to what we're talking about, right? Just what we're talking about with the time. Jahi went in for tonsil surgery, and there's complications, and she experienced an anoxic brain injury. And within a relatively short period of time, I think it was within days, they were pressuring the mom and dad to stop treatment. And Naila and Marvin, the parents, were going to fight. They felt that they wanted more time, and we found kind of.
In fact, the hospital assured everybody that she was brain dead.
Right, they diagnosed her as being brain dead. I think it was Children's Hospital in Oakland at the time.
Correct.
And your neck of the woods where you're living at one
then,
time.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we the father and I spoke, and we said, okay, we'll see what we can do to help. The news was, it was already making a bit of local news out in California. So we intervened, and it was a heck of a fight, Wesley. I mean, I remember the hospital spokesperson. I could not believe some of the things he was saying when he was describing Jahi and how insensitive he was being in describing this young girl. I think she might have been, was she 15 at the time, I think, or 14?
13, something like
yeah.
that.
So anyway, long story short, we were able to help the family, and she got transferred to a hospital in New Jersey, essentially saving her life. But Naila, the mother, had to agree with the coroner. In order for them to release her, she had to agree. They had to issue a death certificate, or else they would not release Jahi.
So the death certificate was issued. Jahi was released to the family, still on life support.
Right.
Jahi was flown to New Jersey, which has an exemption for religious belief in terms of brain death.
Right.
And then Jahi kept insisting that her daughter was not brain dead, correct?
And eventually was able to prove that. She had some doctors come out and examine Jahi, and they came to the conclusion, I think there was two or three neurologists that saw her interacting at some level and believed that she was not brain dead. And I think that the family was involved in a court action to prove that she was, in fact, not brain dead.
You actually had me out to meet Jahi. I'll never forget that day. We went out there, and I remember a lot of castigation of the mother, that she was just in it for the money or she was obsessed. Well, what I saw was a woman who was fiercely dedicated to her daughter. And then at one point, there had been videos. She'd been posting videos of Jahi, who was seriously disabled. There's no question about it. She was in a devastated condition, but reacting to her mother's requests. And we were standing at Jahai's bed, and Naila said, Jahi, put your thumb and finger together, index finger together. And I was standing right there, and I watched Jahai's hand tremble. And then nothing happened, and Naila said, she's more reactive at night. And then suddenly I saw, not as a spasm, but a very slow, deliberate putting together of thumb and index finger, and I almost came out of my shoes. There was no question that she, because people with brain injury take time to respond, there was no question she was responding to her mother's request. And it struck me that Jahi had actually a very important case for science, because Alan Schumann, the neurologist, who said that she was not brain dead, and of course he doesn't believe in brain death as an accurate diagnosis, but he said that the hospital had actually diagnosed her according to proper criteria, and that those criteria no longer applied to Jahi, which means she had regained function. You would have thought that the science world would have wanted to examine her and see her and talk to her to find out what was going on, because this could present a complete change in the belief about brain injury. But that didn't happen, did it?
It did not. In fact, Yeah, you're right, Wesley. At some, she had some type of consciousness at some level, because she was responding to the commands of her mom. I was living in Philadelphia at the time, and it was not far from where they were living, and I would go visit Jahai and Nail and Marvin, as much as I could at the time.
I think that's really an important service that you provided, and that is you're standing with somebody in solidarity. Sometimes that's what people need, to know that they're not crazy, and to know that their fight for their loved one isn't something that should cast them aspersions upon them.
Well, one of the things to this day that frustrates me is many of the people that are making these decisions or are commenting or having an opinion about Terry, Jahai, these individuals with these brain injuries, have never cared for or experienced anyone with a brain injury. So I don't know how they would come to any type of understanding of what it's like to have a loved one in these types of conditions. But yet they're the ones not only commenting or having opinions about it, but they're making law and policy about these types of people and applying it to the type of people they've never met or cared for, which is...
And aren't they dehumanizing?
We're in today.
They're dehumanizing them. They're right. Saying that they're basically less equal, less human, and denying their sheer humanity. And it's really disturbing. And it's not to say that people have to always continue life support, but you have to treat the individual as an individual, as a patient, and you have to treat the family with respect. And you're saying, based on what you're seeing at the foundation, that there's some difficulties there.
I see it all the time, and Terry's case still provokes a lot of controversy. And the way they talk about my sister, it's upsetting and troubling, obviously. But yeah, this whole undermining of human dignity of the compassion and the love that these individuals, the response we should give them, and which should be compassion and love and caring for them, it's been turned on its head, it seems. And that's what we're fighting today, Wes, so you know that. And it's...
I think it's important, and it's almost a thankless job, because people don't want to think about it. People don't want to see it. You know, we're almost out of time, and there's a new project that you're engaged in that I think people should hear about, the Terry Shavo Home for the Brain Injured. Tell us a bit about that.
Sure. Well, it's a collaboration with Catholic Healthcare International, and they're developing a medical center in Howell, Michigan, which is right outside of Ann Arbor, not too far. And they've already purchased a hospital. Trinity Healthcare Systems will be vacating a hospital in Howell. And once they vacate it, Catholic Healthcare International will assume it. We're looking at June of 2026. And within this hospital, there's going to be a Terry Shavo Home for the Brain Injured, and that essentially, Wesley, is going to be a facility that's going to cater and provide rehabilitation services and therapy services to people like my sister. What it's going to look like, we're still in the beginning stages. We haven't hired a rehab doctor yet, so there's still a lot of work to be done. But essentially, it's going to be a home for the brain injured in my sister's name. Something my dad had always talked about and wanting before he had passed away. And it'll just be a wonderful legacy and something, Terry's name will be forever attached to. And we're really excited about it. And I can't wait for the day we're up and running and we have our grand opening.
I think that's a wonderful, positive tribute to Terry. And I think it's also a proactive way to protect people who are being abandoned by the system and by too many people who think that they no longer have lives worth living.
Yes, we're this has been many, many years in the working. And we've been blessed to be introduced to Catholic Healthcare International. Their president, Jer, I always have a tough name with this. He's an Italian guy. Palazzolo, Jer Palazzolo. We met about 4 or 5 years ago, and he just embraced our idea. And we're just blessed that he is so willing and wanting to have Terry's rehab center part of his vision, which is replicating, I didn't mention, it's what it is, Wesley, he's replicating Padre Pio's, a Catholic saint. He's replicating his hospital over in Italy, and he's going to do it here in the United States, and we're going to be part of it. It's exciting, and we're going to keep people updated, and we're having a big event March 22nd up in Michigan to celebrate or commemorate Terry's 20th anniversary of her death, and we'll be talking about the Home for the Brain Injured and the medical center at this event in next week, and we're just going to keep working, and we got to raise a lot of money, and that's going to be the hard part, but God willing, he brought us this far, and hopefully God will provide, and we'll be having a grand opening in about a year from now.
You know, you've been in the public eye for now more than 20 years. What do you know now that you didn't know then?
Well, I still don't like it, Wesley. I mean, you mentioned before, I still feel like I'm a very private person. In many ways, I've always been kind of introverted. You might not believe that, but I am. But what have I learned? There's a lot of people suffering out there. There's a lot of people that aren't getting the care that they need. There's a lot of lives that are being ended prematurely. And we're just trying to do what we can to help. And that's all we can do. The healthcare system, as you know, it's very complex. It's a monster, Wesley. And I don't know if there's going to be any fundamental change that's going to happen that's going to do better protecting these individuals than we have in place right now. But, you know, if we can help those along the way, help save a life or help give the treatment to these individuals, as many as we can along the way, then that's what we're going to keep doing, and that's what we'll try to do. So we're just blessed to be in this position. And I got to tell you, of all the sadness and all the terrible, I guess if you want to call it evil, we've experienced all these years, and even during Terry's case, I mean, we've been blessed so much along the way. This what I just mentioned, this rehab center in Terry's name, the people in the organizations. God, I've made so many wonderful friends during this fight and subsequent to Terry's death. And my own journey, kind of going back to my Catholic faith because of Terry's situation. So much. I know that you can kind of live in nihilistic times, right? And there is a lot of bad that's going on out there, but we've been blessed with a lot of wonderful people,
which gives hope for the world. I mean,
give all the glory to God.
It's really important. Well, you know, when the center opens, I hope you'll come back on the podcast.
It'd be my pleasure, and I hope you get come up and visit it sometimes. Love to have you.
I would definitely do that.
Thank you, Wesley. I mean, you're one of the lone wolves out there, and it's only because of you, I think, that we're able to do what we do, and able to alert people with what's happening in healthcare. I mean, you've been at this a lot longer than me, and God bless you. I mean, there's not too many people out there doing what you're doing and letting people know just kind of the realities of what's happening in our healthcare today. So thank you.
Well, you're the ones who put I write and I speak, but you guys put your whole beings on the line. Bobby, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Wesley.
Thanks for listening to Humanize from Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism, where human rights meet human responsibilities. Discover all the good work of the Center on Human Exceptionalism by visiting discovery.org/human. We can only do this work, speaking on behalf of human life, human thriving, and our exceptional place in this world and our cosmos, with your support. We invite you to make a one-time gift today and to consider starting a monthly gift to support the Center on Human Exceptionalism and this show. Wherever you're listening to Humanize, please take a moment to rate and review the show. You matter. Your actions matter. Be bold, be exceptional, and be back soon.